and then in 1485. And Henry Tudor, who was a scion of the House of Lancaster, married Elizabeth of York, and peace was restored to England. Henry was a strong individual. He had well-defined objectives for his government, and he knew how to accomplish his aims. The period of the 16th century is a period in which you have the development of strong monarchies in France and in Spain, particularly. And you see the same phenomenon in England under Henry VII. There are authorities who believe that Henry VII is the strongest of the Tudor kings. Perhaps it is correct that he is the strongest of the Tudor kings. The Tudor queens, good Queen Bess perhaps, could have bested him. Henry VII knew that he needed a strong financial basis for his government. And he used various agents in order to tighten up the tax collection system in his country and in order to extend the taxation in England. There was, for instance, Morton, who was Archbishop of Canterbury and Chancellor of the Realm. He devised what was known as Morton's Fork. It was difficult for anyone to slip through this fork and not to pay taxes. Then, too, Henry was anxious to promote the economic welfare of his country. One of the factors that had led to the Hundred Years' War, the war between France and England, had been the rivalry for trade with the Netherlands, as well as for the wine trade of Gascony. And Henry VII took steps in order to strengthen the trade with the Netherlands. In 1496, he signed a treaty with various cities in the Netherlands, the Magnus Intercursus, a trade treaty, which is of tremendous importance, I believe, for the economic welfare of England, for giving the government, the monarchy, a strong financial base. And without a strong financial base, Henry VIII would not have been able, we can postulate at least, to break with Rome. Henry VIII may not have been aware entirely of the commercial revolution. The revolution in trade, which siphoned off the main trade routes from the Mediterranean and brought them into the Atlantic. But Henry VIII furthered the commercial revolution. And this commercial revolution in the history of Europe is of first-ranking importance. One historian has said it tilted Europe toward the West. It means now that Europe faces the Atlantic instead of facing into the Mediterranean, instead of being concerned about the trade routes over the Alps between Italy and Germany. The Atlantic, and to a lesser degree the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, become more important than the Mediterranean. And it means that the countries that are bordering the Atlantic are of greater consequence for the history of Europe than those that are inland. It means that Spain, France, England, the Netherlands, and in the 17th century Sweden become the dominant countries in Europe. And the Holy Roman Empire recedes gradually as far as its as far as the political importance of this territory is concerned. It means that these countries are concerned, of course, about the discoveries in the New World. Discoveries that had been inaugurated from Portugal with Don Enrico, Prince Henry the Navigator, which had been furthered by explorers coming from the southern part of Europe primarily. But Henry VIII also furthered the exploration. The Cabots were subsidized by him. He might have given them a little bit more money, but nobody ever accused Henry VIII of being open-handed and lavish with the shillings and pence and pounds that he had at his disposal. But Henry VIII furthered these explorations, and he also furthered a strong navy. He's known as the father of the English Navy. You might want to dispute his claims to paternity there. But at any rate, he took measures to greatly strengthen the English Navy. And it was the English Navy again, which for the other Tudors, particularly for Henry VIII and for Elizabeth, became a very strong bulwark of their power. And then Henry VIII also allied himself with some of the major powers in Europe. The way to do that in the last part of the 15th and the first part of the 16th century was to form a marriage alliance. Diplomacy in that day was carried out, at least to a large extent, by domestic relations. The greatest power in Europe was in Spain. Ferdinand and Isabella were reigning there. Henry VIII negotiated successfully a marriage between his son Arthur and the daughter of Catherine and Ferdinand, Catherine of Aragon. That Arthur died before he became king, no one could tell when the marriage was celebrated early in 1509. Henry VII also negotiated a marriage between his daughter Margaret and James IV of Scotland, in order, in part at least, to bring peace to the Scottish border. And this marriage incidentally explains why the House of Stuart, after the death of Elizabeth, came to the throne of England with the person of James I. That nationalism is prevalent in England during the 16th century can be demonstrated and illustrated in various ways. I'm going back for an illustration. To the year 1559, this doesn't come, of course, from the period of Henry VII, but I think this will illustrate for you the extreme nationalism in England in the 16th century. It reached its height in 1588 at the time of the defeat of the Spanish Armada. But in 1557, when Elizabeth was made queen, there were some people that were wondering whether or not there ought to be another woman on the throne of England. John Knox had issued his trumpet blast against the monstrous regiment of women because he didn't like Bloody Mary, he didn't like Catherine of the Medici, and he didn't favor at all the reign of Mary Stuart in Scotland. When Elizabeth became queen, here was a Protestant, and this gave John Knox some second thoughts. But the Bishop of London, appointed by Elizabeth, a man by the name of John Aylmer, wrote a reply to John Knox. And in this reply, he refers to the glories of England. He says that God raised up his prophets, he raised up Luther to proclaim the truth, and Luther was begat by Huss, and Huss was begat by Wycliffe. So out of thy womb, O England, came the truth. And in the margin of the 1559 edition of this book, opposite this passage, as a marginal notation, printed, God is English. This, I think, will illustrate what the attitude in England was, yes, a half a century after Henry VII. But you don't get this sort of national feeling inside of 50 years. It's there long before that generation is born. The Englishman was very proud of his heritage, and Henry VII fostered this. As king, in order to bolster up his monarchy, in order to do what he could for the welfare of his country. Henry VII, in 1509, was succeeded by his second son, Henry, who of course became Henry VIII. Henry VIII was king from 1509 to 1547. And Henry VIII has been described as every inch a king. He had a lot of inches, especially around his waist. Henry VIII married his brother's widow. He married Catherine of Aragon. Received a special dispensation from the Pope. The Pope at the time happened to be Julius II. There are some indications that at the time Henry registered a mild protest. This became much louder when he listened back about 20 years later. But in 1509, if such a protest was registered, it was very mild. Henry VIII was not, in my opinion, as capable as his father. He was more concerned in enjoying the monarchy. At the same time, of course, he wanted to see England as a strong power in Europe. Now, the history of Henry VIII's reign is concerned mainly with the developments in the what we call the Reformation or the ecclesiastical change there. In the main, Henry VIII tried to continue his father's policies as far as trade and the navy and so on were concerned. He, for a while, followed an anti-French policy. In harmony with the marriage which he had made, because Francis I and his, later on in his realm, in his reign at least, Charles V, the uncle of his wife, were opposed to the French. In the famous Battle of the Spurs in 1513, he defeated the French, and in the same year he defeated the Scotch, who weren't quite sure that the brother-in-law would respect his sister's interests, or the interests of his sister's husband in Scotland. And at the Battle of Flodden Field in 1513, James IV was defeated and killed. The most noteworthy event, politically speaking, in the reign of Henry VIII outside of the Reformation events was the appointment of Thomas Wolsey as Chancellor. Wolsey was Archbishop of York. He was Legatus a Latere. He was appointed a cardinal. He was the most powerful man in England, next to the king himself. Wolsey had ambitions to become pope and used the English political arena in order to further his ambitions. He never made it. There are historians who believe that Wolsey tried to play the role of mediator, trying to keep a balance of power in politics. There are reasons to believe that this was his attitude. By and large, however, Wolsey with Henry VIII was concerned with allying himself with the Spanish and papal interests. In the reign of Henry VIII, we have to take into consideration the place of Parliament, because the ecclesiastical changes were made directly by laws that were passed by Parliament. To go back into the history of Parliament would complicate matters too much for us at the present time. We probably ought to answer the question whether or not Henry VIII sacked the Parliament. They were favorable toward him. I don't think that he used undue pressure to get people in Parliament that were favorable to him. Parliament operated on the theory of the crown in Parliament. The king, through his advisors, was able to manipulate the Parliament to a greater extent, of course, than the monarchy can today. But Tudor absolutism should never be considered as being so absolute that the king could go contrary to the entire wishes of Parliament. The king might lead Parliament. He might persuade Parliament. But he could never override Parliament completely. I believe that this fact has to be kept in mind when we consider the political, ecclesiastical changes that are made by the Reformation Parliament under Henry VIII between 1529 and 1536. Two acts of Parliament, I think, ought to be mentioned. Before the reign of Henry VIII, and one is the Statute of Provisos, which comes from the year 1351. And the other is the Statute of Praemunire, P-R-A-E-M-U-N-I-R-E, Praemunire, the Latin word, of course. The Statute of Provisos simply provided that the king had the last word in the appointment of bishops and abbots and so forth. The Statute of Praemunire of the year 1393, there's an earlier act from 1353, but the important one is from 1393. The 1393 Statute of Praemunire provided that no bull, edict, papal document of any kind could be promulgated in England without the express consent of the king. This piece of legislature plays a part in the maneuvers again with the Parliament from between 1529 and 1536, and that's why we have to mention it. So these are some of the factors that go into the strengthening of the monarchy in England, the role that is played by the king, particularly Henry VII, first of all, who laid the foundations, and then Henry VIII, who, in the words of somebody's words, at least broke the bonds of Rome. Henry VIII, who broke the bonds of Rome. The Reformation in England is due not only to political factors, it is due to ideological, intellectual factors. The relationship between the Renaissance and the Reformation as a whole is an extremely complicated topic, and it's even more complicated in many respects as far as the English scene is concerned. The English Renaissance followed in part the Italian Renaissance. You have as an important figure in the English Renaissance, the early English Renaissance, William Grocyn, G-R-O-Y-G-R-O-C-Y-N, William Grocyn, and then particularly Lineker, Thomas Lineker, L-I-N-A-C-R-E. Grocyn died in 1519, Lineker died in 1524, these dates are given you merely for reference purposes. Lineker promoted the study of the Latin and Greek classics in England. Lineker was trained in Italy, as was Grocyn. Lineker, however, was a physician and established the Royal College of Physicians in England. Both of these men were strong humanists and helped to pave the way for the humanists who were very active in the Reformation of England. Among these humanists, we ought to note particularly the Oxford Reformers. There are three men, Thomas More, John Collett, and Erasmus, who are listed among the Oxford Reformers. Erasmus, who died in 1536, date of his birth is uncertain, perhaps 1469. But Erasmus, who died in 1536, spent several periods in England, two periods in England to be specific, one at Oxford and one at Cambridge. And it was in England, I think that we can say, that Erasmus became interested in the reform of the church. It was after his second stay in England, for instance, that he issued his Novum Instrumentum, the New Testament of 1516, and this is a prime event in the history of the Reformation, Erasmus' New Testament of 1516. It was in England that Erasmus began his editing of the church fathers, especially St. Jerome. He got out editions of St. Jerome of St. Augustine. And it was in England primarily that Erasmus promulgated his Philosophia Christi, his emphasis on Christian ethics. Erasmus influenced Sir Thomas More, who died in 1535, executed in 1535, known also as Saint Thomas More. You know Thomas More is the author of the Utopia. You ought to know him as a promoter of humanism. He was also an antagonist of Luther and wrote against William Tyndale. He did not favor the policies of Henry VIII, although he was appointed chancellor in 1529, and for his refusal to take the oath of supremacy, he lost his head. And then the third of the Oxford Reformers is John Collett, who died in 1519. John Collett had visited Italy. He came back, lectured at Oxford. He established St. Paul's School in London, known for the promotion of biblical studies and education in general. His great interest in secondary education and the Latin grammar school that he established there in London ought to be noted. John Collett preached a notable sermon to convocation, which is all the clergy of England. And listed the evils of the church in England. The simony, the greed, the ignorance, the jealousy, the lack of concern for pastoral care are some of the items that he mentions in his convocation sermon of 1512. He has sometimes been listed as a pre-reformer. I think that the title is a bit dubious. In the July 1963 issue of Concordia Theological Monthly, you will find an article, John Collett's Significance for the English Reformation. I recommend your reading the article. There are forces then in England that are asking for a reformation of the church, especially these voices like Erasmus, Moore, and Collett. In England, there is a great deal of anti-clericalism. Anti-clericalism that dates back at least into the 12th century. We can't go into the Constitution of Clarendon, the Clarendon Code of 1164. I'm going to pass over saying any more about the Statute of Primunire. We mentioned that from 1393. But certainly the Statute of Primunire is an indication of some anti-papal feelings. We have John Wycliffe in England. Wycliffe died in 1384. And the Lollard movement. The Lollards emphasized the reading of the scriptures, denied the doctrine of transubstantiation, and ask for the dissemination of the scriptures in the vernacular. The question has been raised whether or not Lollardy persisted in England into the 16th century. And the answer is a very definite and a very positive yes, it did. It persisted in England, even in the northern part of England. A.G. Dickens has gone into the manuscript records of the archives of the Archbishopric of York and has examined the trials for heresy in England during the first half of the 16th century. He has documented very fully the persistence of Lollardy and of Lollard ideas in England even after you have the Lutheran and Calvinistic doctrines coming into the country. So that we can say very positively that the anti-papal and anti-sacramentarian views of the Lollards persisted up until the time of the Reformation. In 1513, there is an important incident that happened. The so-called Hun incident, H-U-N-N-E, in which Hun was accused of holding back the mortmain, of not paying the funeral fees, thrown into the jail by the Bishop of London, Fitzjames, and found dead. The report was that, well, the man committed suicide. The populace of London rose up because it was claimed that he was killed by the jailer and one of his helpers. And Bishop Fitzjames said, and the remark is well documented, that he could not find a jury in London who would not find his clerk guilty. So persistent and so deep felt was this feeling against the Bishop of London. It's an illustration of what we mean by the anti-clericalism. It wasn't tied up only with the presence of Lollardy. In London, you have the so-called just fast men, in quotations, just fast men. We don't know much about them. They aren't lawless. Sometimes they're referred to as Christian brethren. But what we do know about them indicates that there was this persistence of hatred against the clergy of the Roman Church. We ought to recognize a persistence of piety in England. You have, for instance, a man like John Collett. John Collett was one of 22 children. He was the only one of his family that reached adulthood. His mother outlived him. She was the mother of these 22 children. But his father was a very rich merchant. And Collett took orders, used his money for the promotion of learning. He must have, from all indications, come from a very pious home. And so we find a great deal of piety. I say that because we also have to recognize in England, as on the continent, the persistence of corruption, of pluralism, and absenteeism. Wolsey is a prime example. Wolsey, Archbishop of York, was in the Cathedral of York once in 15 years. He held, I think it was, at least 8 different livings in England, besides being chancellor. And this thing can be multiplied by hundreds of examples in England of men holding 2 or 3 ecclesiastical offices, absent from their charges. And this, of course, makes for a deterioration of religion. Most lamentable, I think, is the fact that you have a decline of the care of souls, a decline in the pastoral functions among the priests, the clergy of England. And became satisfied to perform their official duties. They'd hear confession, sure. They'd perform their burials and marriages and baptisms. They'd say their masses and then go to the alehouse. They were not concerned about the spiritual welfare of their people. And again, this can be documented from, I'm willing to say, hundreds of examples from the records that we have in England from the first half of the 16th century. And to my mind, this is, besides the corruption of doctrine, this is the real breakdown of the Roman Church in England. On Monday, we'll pick up with the introduction of Lutheranism, the legal break with Rome, go on to the reign of Edward VI, Bloody Mary, the religious settlement of 1559, and the introduction of Puritanism. We've got a big order ahead of us.